we're back on the record. The respondents have cross-examination of Mr. Bishop. And, Mr. Bishop, you're still under oath.
Thank you. Mr. Bishop, as we discussed, if at any point you find it easier to refer to the exhibits up there, I'd invite you to do that.
Okay.
To switch, we'll accommodate that. Where we left off, we were talking about design vehicles. Does the frequency with which a vehicle uses a driveway figure into your assessment of whether it should be a design vehicle for that driveway?
Yes. I think it does.
And what kind of frequency would you need in order to be considered a design vehicle?
Well, if it's a vehicle that normally and regularly uses the driveway, it's in a normal course of business that would be a design vehicle that I want to use for that driveway.
Mr. Bishop, I'm going to hand you a copy of your deposition transcript. I'd like to ask you, is that consistent with the testimony you gave under oath earlier?
Okay.
Could you please turn to page 13, excuse me, page 17, and they're grouped in pages of four. I'm looking at lines 13 and 14. When I asked you the same question, you had testified that the frequency is not really a criteria.
Well, let's see.
Does it happen?
I'm on page 17 that includes pages 62 to 65.
I apologize. I'm looking at the page numbers of the smaller reproduced
pages. Smaller
page. So page 17 of the transcript. They're in the upper right-hand corner of each of them. I'm looking at lines 13 and 14. When I asked you that question, you testified that this frequency is not really a criteria. It's, does it happen? And I heard you say something very different this time, so I'm wondering which is it. Is frequency a criteria or not?
I think if it happens once a year, it probably isn't a criteria. If it happens regularly at a business, it's a criteria.
So your testimony now is the testimony that you gave under oath before is we should just ignore?
I said my thought was that it's not the frequency that is does it happen. That's what it says there, yeah. And, you know, I'm not thinking about ever in the life of the project, but with some level of frequency.
Some level of frequency. So is it your testimony that all the ones that appeared on your chart that's at the first page of 310, I guess it's Exhibit 1 now, Exhibit 1 happened with, what was it, some frequency?
Some level of frequency, yeah. This is what the business owners say that they have come in and out of their driveway.
And where along that line does it cross to where you need to consider it? With some frequency, what does that mean? That sounds a little vague to me.
It'd be hard to define, I suppose. I guess I'm back on, well, if it happens once a year, you know, If the lowboys only showed up at CSR Marine once a year, that probably would not be something you have to worry about. But in their normal course of business and part of what they do, they have the lowboys come and go. Something you ought to be thinking about in the design of the access to that facility.
So, and is it correct that you interviewed the business owners of these facilities for
either owners or operation managers or dispatchers or people who were familiar with the business.
And what guidance did you give them in terms of the frequency that they should be thinking about when determining?
I probably didn't give them any guidance. I just asked them what kind of trucks come in and out. in one of the biggest trucks.
Okay. But you didn't ask them to consider only ones that appeared with some frequency?
No.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about another topic you raised before we broke for lunch. We're talking about the difference between designing for a vehicle and accommodating the vehicle. Can you describe what that means to you, the differences between those two concepts, designing for a vehicle and accommodating a vehicle?
So for me, if you're going to design a driveway for a commercial operation that is running on a designated truck street, truck arterial, it seems to me that you should be designing the intersections in your new design and the driveways so that it would accommodate the size of trucks that regularly use that street and those driveways.
I think you just answered the question of which you think is relevant here. I guess I'm asking if you know the distinction between what it means to design an intersection for a truck versus what it means to accommodate that truck at an intersection.
Well, to accommodate means it is lawful for a truck to cross the center line. So in my mind, an accommodation means that you are going to assume that the truck is going to regularly cross the center line, use the other side of the roadway, use all the throat width of either the public street or the driveway that they're going into, and that's accommodation. The design for it is to assume that you've got multiple traffic flows in all directions and have to be maintained, and the truck can get in and around and through the intersection without interfering with the other traffic in the intersection. That would be designing for. To accommodate it, says, okay, well, it's good enough to let them wait and hold up traffic and let everybody else get out of the way so then I can physically make it through the space. That's accommodation.
And do you agree that the design in the EIS accommodates truck movements?
No. I showed several examples where they don't accommodate. You have to go outside of the roadway.
Roadway?
Yeah, like at Market and 24th, that left-turning truck. It has to get outside of the roadway.
Let's focus on the driveways. Do you agree that the driveways can accommodate trucks, that the design shown will allow the driveways to accommodate trucks?
Well, the limited design shown, the 10% level, in most cases, there was one case where you can't make a right turn out of one of the driveways up on Market and stay in the roadway. But mostly it accommodates the trucks if you go on the opposite side.
I'm going to ask you a couple questions about the incursion zone that's shown on the documents. And I think the examiner had asked you a couple questions that may have clarified this, but is it, just to make sure I'm understanding it, is it correct to say that the area shown as an incursion zone exceeds the area of the trail that a truck would actually cross?
Yes, it gets into the buffer zone adjacent to the trail.
And so what's the far boundary of that incursion zone? How do you measure that far boundary?
It's the curb line between the buffer and the through street.
But what about the curb line?
It's where the swept path crosses the curb line.
And the truck then enters the street?
Then it enters the street, bounds over the curb and enters the street, yeah.
And you just drew a line?
And then I went perpendicular to that point, drew a line along the trail. Yes.
Okay. I heard you say a couple times in your testimony that we defined or we called it the incursion zone. Did you create that concept?
In collaboration with Transpo.
For purposes of this?
Yes, exercise. Yes.
Okay. Is it, Are you aware of any design standards or regulations or guidelines that talk about the incursion zone the way that you've described?
I am not.
For purposes of this specific issue, the issue of conflict between trucks leaving and entering driveways with non-motorized transportation, have you analyzed that? Have you analyzed existing conditions to identify whether or not that conflict exists today?
Well, there are all kinds of conflicts along social. Sure. Yes, I haven't analyzed it, but I've observed it.
So when you said that the auto turn analysis that you're testifying to demonstrated to you more than a likelihood of more than a moderate impact, was that did you compare it all to what that existing condition was?
Well, the existing condition doesn't put contraflow bicycles along those driveways. It's about the contraflow of the bicycles on the two-way side path, that's the whole issue in my mind. You're now introducing this worst-case contraflow bicycle along an extremely busy commercial arterial.
I guess I'm asking, I understand that.
And that doesn't exist today. And right now, the few bicycles or the bicycles that do ride along Shoshone, you know, ride with the traffic. So the contraflow doesn't exist.
And pedestrians? What's your understanding of pedestrians under existing conditions?
In some places there's a sidewalk, and in a lot of places there is no sidewalk.
And so is your understanding of existing conditions that there are, I think you just used the word few, a few bicycles that use it today, is that your understanding of existing conditions?
Well, I don't know. I haven't, let's see. Trying to remember, I think there's some data in the EIS that talks about bicycles, and you can infer from some of the turning movements how many bikes there are on those along there by subtracting one intersection from another. You can say, okay, well, there's this many that's going along this section.
Have you done any work yourself to assess the bicycle? The amount of bicyclists or pedestrians along that corridor, and have you done any work yourself to then assess potential conflict with truck movements?
No. I did review the projected numbers that's in the EIS, and they had a set of numbers to the east on the trail and another set to the west, and they're largely different. And there was some projections as to what might show up on the trail itself.
Okay. You had used, in your testimony, you talked about an 11-to-1 ratio according to one piece of information you had. What was that one piece of information, do you recall?
That's a Department of Transportation design standard, chapter 10.10. Something, I don't recall. I think it was submitted as an exhibit, submitted as a disclosure document.
Okay.
I don't recall the number off the top of my head. But then, of course, there's the Seattle right-of-way manual that specifically refers to the WSDOT design manual. So there's a connection there. It's not just WSDOT. It's Seattle must use the WSDOT design standards.
Let's talk a little bit about your parking analysis. You'd said that in answer to Mr. Schneider's questions, you had done work for commercial developments on parking analyses for commercial developments?
Yes.
And did any of those involve an EIS?
Actually, I think one of them did. Yeah,
okay.
At least a SEPA. Maybe it might have been an EA, or you know, it might not have been a full EIS, but it was involved in a SEPA. and it was mixed. Excuse
me. And I want to be very specific. I'm talking about an EIS that includes an alternative.
I don't think so.
I'd like to ask you a couple questions about your evaluation. And first, on, I think you have the notebook there in front of you, but on page 40 of Exhibit 1, that's the one where you summarize the incursion zones and the percentage within the incursion zones, and there's a separate table at the bottom that talks about the parking spot turn maneuvers conflict with.
Yep.
Those five spots that are shown there, are those, let me step back. In the table above, I think you distinguish between within available pavement and within lane. And my question is the table below showing what happens if the trucks stay within available pavement or within available lane?
I believe that that's within available lane.
Okay.
That's the more restrictive.
And do you know what the answer would be if they stayed within available pavement?
I don't. I could sort through and figure it out, but
that's okay.
I don't have that on my head.
Then on page 53, which I think talks more about parking, I just want to ask you a couple questions. There's two tables shown there, and I'm focusing on the top one of the two. Can you tell me where you derived that information from?
It's from the parking study in the EIS.
So this is all based on that analysis? You didn't do any separate parking counts?
No.
Do you know whether the no-build parking supply includes unregulated parking?
I had a hard time figuring out whether.
No.
There's unregulated parking between in the railroad track area or along Shoshone. I don't think that does include the unregulated parking, although the EIS says that the unregulated parking area will still be available.
So is your, I'm sorry, I don't know that I got the answer there. Is that you're not sure or that you don't think it includes it?
I don't think it includes it.
Okay. And what about, I'm going to ask the same question about the, when the preferred alternative parking supply.
Same thing. I mean, they're under the same criteria.
Okay.
Whether they're included or not, it's the same situation.
Let's turn to the bridge concept. I just want to make sure I'm understanding. Did you compare what is depicted on the bridge concept design with the swept path analysis? Did you ensure that the swept path wouldn't encroach on any of the supporting columns?
Yes. I looked at that. And that one column, number 6, is the critical one, and which is the one between driveway. Now let's see. Between driveway 9D and driveway 10, that's between the trucks have to cross the center line in order to get around that column if they're making a right turn out. If certain trucks have to make a right turn to get out of driveway 9D, they have to cross the center line and use the available pavement. They can't do it without and stay in their lane in that center, in that one, on that one column.
One?
I think that's the only one.
And then I wanted to just be clear on your testimony. Did you assess whether the height of the structure would restrict the access for any of the vehicles that you reviewed under the auto turn analysis at each of those driveways?
It would not. It would not restrict the access.
Let's focus on the design. Does this design include any access points beyond the beginning and the end that are depicted? Can you get on in the middle somewhere?
Oh, on the
bridge.
On the bridge. No. No, it's you get on one and the other.
And so it doesn't include any extra stairs or elevator or anything like that?
No. You can always add those things if that's what somebody would like to do. Add to the cost, of course.
You have a sense of order of magnitude what it takes to add an elevator?
No, I don't. But it's...
Have you assessed whether there's room within the existing footprint to actually construct that?
I don't think there is, no. There's essentially, it's 12 and 2 on the railroad side and 5 on the roadside. You got a total of 17 feet. And if you got a 14-foot structure in there somewhere, you probably don't have room to add it. Okay. You might be able to cantilever the platform out over the top and swing it down around underneath somehow. I don't know, but not in a logical way.
Did you assess any site distance impacts that might occur with the construction of columns in the proximity of driveways?
I don't think that the columns are 4-foot diameter columns, and there's room in there, so in my opinion, that would not be a problem. That would not introduce an additional problem.
Beyond parked cars, you don't view that as being a problem at all? I mean, parked cars, I think, sometimes have been referred to as a site distance issue in the proximity of driveways. So you don't think a column would be?
Well, parked cars are longer and have much. It's kind of like a column's kind of like a tree, a little bit bigger than a tree. But, you know, trees become a site distance problem when they're all lined up and you can't see between various trees. But these columns aren't that close together.
Okay. Let's talk about the cost estimate. I believe in the exhibit it refers to a $300 per square foot estimate.
Yes.
And can you tell me what that comes from?
Yes, that's a... I'm going to have to go back to the... That's identified in the report by CTS. That's the WSDOT Bridge Design Manual, Appendix 12.3-A1.
And do you remember at all looking at other comparable projects in the area to derive at a cost per square foot in your work for this?
I wouldn't necessarily call it a comparable project, but the Thomas Street Bridge, bike bridge, was one that came to mind. It crosses over Elliott down at Thomas Street and crosses over the Burlington Northern Railroad tracks and connects a park on the waterfront with a commercial area to the east.
And do you recall what that cost was per square foot of that facility?
Well, we tried to get at that, and the best way we could do it is... I think we got a total project cost for that structure and a length and a width, and we multiplied it out. I think it was in 1,100 linear feet of length or 1,000 feet, something like that. Anyhow, I calculated out at over $800 a square foot.
Okay. And to what do you attribute that difference between the 300 and the 800?
Well, a lot of it is the way Seattle does things. A part of it's got to be with having to deal with the Burlington Northern Railroad, Santa Fe, Burlington Santa Fe Railroad, and getting whatever easements and rights to cross over their track. Part of it's got to do with, I'm sure that the, I don't know for a fact, but I'm quite sure that the span over the railroad tracks is longer than 125 feet. The length of the span of the structure is quite dramatically impacts the cost of the structure. There is a stairway on the Thomas Street Bridge that goes down on the west side of Elliott Avenue. There's a a view platform at a right angle over by the park that's not that's extended. So there's a whole bunch of elements that go into that structure that I don't think would be necessary at this structure. You might want to add, somebody might decide they want to add something to the structure, but they don't have to.
So that access point you think is not necessary here?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, that was going over crossing an arterial, Elliott, and that was an ability to get up and down and get over the railroad tracks from Elliott without having to go 600 feet the other direction and to get up on top. I mean, that's a totally different orientation of the travel. In this case, we're just talking about basically bicycles longitudinally along the side of one road, as opposed to the other one who's crossing.
And that's your understanding of the objective of this project?
Yeah.
Okay. Can I, and this might be obvious from the design drawings, but just to ask you to clarify, if the design concept here still shows the other improvements to the rest of the street. In other words, the rest of the street is still going to have to shift north. Is that right?
This concept it was to use the footprint that the proposal would require, and that footprint of the proposal is to shift it to the north. So the answer is yes. That's the thought.
Bear with me for just 1 second. The city is finished with questions. Thank you, Mr. Bishop. I don't know if...
Thank you.
I have a few.
Mr. Bishop, I'm Matt Cohen for the Cascade Bike Club, and I really do have just a few questions for you.
Okay.
Mr. Cohen, I'm sorry, could you either move forward or move your mic towards you either way?
Thank you.
It's a little, about 5 or 6 feet. It's
thank you.
Difficult.
You testified this morning that the Transpo firm did all of the auto turn modeling that you testified about. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Who did you work with at Transpo?
Well, Scott Kozlicki was the project manager, and Bryce Kinney. I think Bryce Kinney was his engineer, and then there was a CAD operator that worked for Bryce. So it's really three people there that were involved.
And was most of your interaction with Mr. Kozlicki?
Well, I met several times with the team in their office, so they were all there. So I interacted with all three of them.
Mm-hmm. Are you personally familiar with the Auto Turn program?
From a management point of view, I don't know how to run it. But I've used AutoTurn for 25 years in my business.
So you have run the program?
I know. I've hired other people to run the program.
So I'm interested in where Transpo got the input parameters to run that program. So, for instance...
From me.
From you. Okay. So you gave them the information on the size of the trucks...
Right.
...plying each driveway?
They actually field inventoried a lot of the additional driveways that have a letter designation on them on my list that were not included in the EIS, and therefore some of which were not included on the CAD drawing. CAD drawing is not necessarily consistent with the EIS in terms of the driveways. There were some included and some not.
Okay, so you might be anticipating my next question, but I want to finish this one first.
Okay.
Who specified the size of the trucks that were going to be modeled for each driveway?
I did.
You did. And that information came from your interviews with the business owners?
Yes.
Okay. Who specified the number and location of the driveways?
Well, we identified every driveway we could find.
And where did you find that information?
Well, some of it was on that CAD drawing. Some of it was on Google Earth photos, and some of it was field inventory.
Field inventory?
Yeah.
Meaning your field observations?
Mm-hmm. No. Ms. Hershey did a field inventory of all the driveways on all the alternatives, and that included some of the driveways on the preferred alternative that we did the AutoCAD on the south side.
So did
so she kind of confirmed what Transpo did in terms of identifying where the driveways are.
Did Ms. Hershey identify driveways that both the CAD drawing and Google Earth did not show?
I don't know. I'll have to ask her.
So who provided the information on the driveways to Transpo?
Either the city through the CAD drawing or Transpo's investigation on their own, either field inventory or through the Google Earth photo inventory.
So when you testified this morning about the number of driveways that are not accounted for in the EIS, that wasn't based on your work?
It was based on the work that I coordinated with Transpo, sure. So I call that my work, yes.
It's your work if Transpo provided you with that information?
Yeah, because I asked them to.
Mm-hmm. What about the information on the width of the driveways that were modeled? Where did that come from?
I believe Transpo did not change the width of any of the driveways shown on the city's CAD drawing, and I believe that those predominantly attempt to represent the existing condition of the existing driveways, although the one at 26 is a clear example of that not being the case. There's no 50-plus foot wide driveway at 26. There's a 20-foot street that comes out, and that's where the driveway is. So that's an exception, but I believe most of them come off of somebody's survey and were represented in the CAD drawing that the city provided.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't you testify this morning that most of the driveways that you analyzed were not included in the EIS?
Included in the table in the EIS that identified driveways and therefore had analysis associated with them. Some of the 29 that were not in that category were indeed on the AutoCAD file drawing, albeit not analyzed.
Uh-huh. And where did Transpo get information about the width of the driveways that were not on the AutoCAD drawing?
I think they either field measured them or measured them off the Google Maps. You can do that. You can scale it.
Do you know where they got that information?
No.
Where did the information come from on the boundaries of the incursion zones?
Well, one boundary is the edge of the driveway, and the other boundary is, as I've said five times, where the swept path crosses the curb line of the between the three lanes and the buffer zone.
Mm-hmm. You referred to a scoring methodology for bicycle path risk that you that was created by the Chicagoland Bicycle Federation?
Yes.
Recall that testimony?
Yes.
And essentially, you took their criteria and applied it to the preferred alternative?
Well, all alternatives, preferred alternative and the other alternatives as well.
And did you run those criteria on the current existing condition?
There are no side paths within the scope of the limits of the existing conditions, and that whole criteria is about two-way side paths. So there are none there, so there's no existing condition to do it on.
So those criteria apply exclusively to two-way side paths?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
No further questions.
All right.